Star Tide Rising, Cassette 11.
Chapter 89. Jillian. She shook her head slowly. Maybe it was her tiredness, but she couldn't understand more than a fraction of the NIST machine's explanation. Every time she tried to get it to simplify some subtle point of galactic tradition, it insisted on bringing in examples that only muddied things further. She felt like a Crow Magnon trying to understand the intrigues in the court of Louis XIV. The NIST seemed to be saying that Streaker's discoveries would have consequences that reached beyond the immediate crisis over the derelict fleet. But the subtleties eluded her. Dr. Baskin, the machine tried again. Every epoch has its turning point. Sometimes it occurs on the battlefield. Sometimes it takes the form of a technological advance. On occasion, the pivotal event is philosophical and so obscure that the species in existence at the time are hardly aware that anything has changed before their worldview is turned topsy-turvy around them. But often, very often, these upheavals are preceded by a legend. I know of no other Anglic word to use for it. A story whose images will stand out in the minds of almost all Sophons. A true story of prodigious deeds and powerful archetypal symbols, which presages the change to come. You're saying we may become one of these legends? That is what I am saying. Jillian could not remember ever feeling so small. She couldn't lift the weight of what the NIST was implying. Her duty to Earth and the lives of 150 friends and crewmates were burdens enough. Archetype symbols, you say? What could be more symbolic, Dr. Baskin, than Streaker and her discoveries? Just one. The derelict fleet has turned the five galaxies upside down. Now add the fact that the discovery was made by the newest of all client races, whose patrons are wolflings, claiming no patrons at all. Here on Kithrop, where no presentient life was supposed to be able to arise, they find a ripe presentient race and take great risks to protect the innocents from a galactic civilization grown rigid and calcified. Now, just, now, add the Kerank. In all of the recent epochs, no sapient race has been treated so foully, so abused by the system which was supposed to protect them. So what were the chances that this ship would happen to flee to the very planet that was their last refuge? Can you not see the overlying images, Dr. Baskin? From the progenitors down to the very newest race, what one sees is a powerful sermon about the uplift system. Whatever the outcome of your attempt to escape Kithrop, whether you succeed or fail, the stars cannot help but make a great song of your adventure. This song, I believe, will change more than you can imagine. The voice of the NIST finished with a hushed, almost reverent tone. Its implication was left spinning in the silence. Jillian stood on the sloping ceiling of the dark, lopsided room, blinking in the sparkling light cast by the swirling motes. The silence hung. Finally, she shook her head. Another damn timbrimey practical joke, she sighed. A goddamn shaggy dog story. You've been pulling my leg. The motes spun silently for a long moment. Would it make you feel any better if I said I were, Dr. Baskin? And would it change what you have to do one bit if I said I weren't? She shrugged. I guess not. At least you pulled me back from my own troubles for a little while. I feel a bit lightheaded from all that philosophical crap and maybe even ready to get some sleep.
I am always ready to be of service.
Jillian smirked.
Sure you are.
She climbed up on a packing crate to reach the door plate, but before opening the door, she looked back up at the machine.
Tell me one thing, Nis. Did you give Crydike any of this bullshit you were feeding me just now?
Not in Anglic words, no. But we did cover most of the same themes.
And he believed you?
Yes, I believe he did. Frankly, I was a bit surprised. It was almost as if he had heard it all before, from another source.
That explained part of the mystery of the captain's disappearance then, and there was nothing that could be done about it now.
Assuming he did believe you, just what does Crydike think he's going to accomplish out there?
The moat spun for a few seconds.
I suppose, Dr. Baskin, he is first off looking for allies. On an entirely different level, I think he is out there trying to add a few choice stanzas to the legend.
Chapter 90 Crydike. They moaned. They had always been in pain. For eons, life had hurt them.
Listen.
He called out in the language of the ancient gods, coaxing the Karank to answer him.
Listen, you deep hidden ones, you sad abused ones, I call from the outside, I crave an audience.
The doleful singing paused. He felt a hint of irritation. It came in both sound and sigh, a shrug to shake a bothersome flea away. The song of lamentation resumed. Crydike kept at it, pushing, probing. He floated at the relay link Streaker had left behind, breathing from his sled's air dome, trying to get the attention of the ancient misanthropes, using the electrical buzz of a distant robot to amplify his faint message.
I call from the outside, seeking aid. Your ancient tormentors are our enemies, too.
That stretched the truth slightly, but not in essence. He hurried on, sculpting sound images as he felt their attention finally swing his way.
We are your brothers. Will you help us?
The growling drone suddenly erupted. The sigh portion felt angry and alien. The part that was sound grated like static. Without his apprenticeship in the Sea of Dreams, Crydike felt certain he would have found it unfathomable.
Do not bother us. Do not say. We have no brothers. We reject the universe. Go away.
Crydike's head rang with the powerful dismissal. Still, the potency of the sigh was encouraging. What Streaker's crew had needed all along was an ally, any ally. They had to have some help. At least a distraction, if Thomas Orley's clever plan of deception and disguise stood a chance of success. As alien and bitter as these underground creatures were, they had once been starfarers. Perhaps they would take some satisfaction in helping other victims of galactic civilization. He persisted.
Look. Listen. Your world is surrounded by gene meddlers. They seek us, and small ones who share this planet with you. They wish to warp us, as they did you. They will invade your private agony.
He crafted a sonic image of great fleets of ships embellished with gaping jaws. He painted over them an impression of malicious intent. His picture was shattered by a thundering response.
We are not involved. Krydike shook his head and concentrated. They may seek you out as well.
They have no use for us. It is you they seek, not us.
The reply dazed him. Krydike had only strength for one more question. He tried to ask what the Korank would do if they were attacked. Before he finished, he was answered by a gnashing that could not be parsed, even in the sense glyphs of the ancient gods. It was more a roar of defiance than anything decipherable. Then, in an instant, the sound and metal echoes cut off. He was left there, drifting with his head ringing from their anger. He had done his best. Now what? With nothing better to do, he closed his eyes and meditated. He clicked out sonar spirals and wove the echoes of the surrounding ridges into patterns. His disappointment subsided as he sensed Nukupai take shape alongside him, her body a complex matting of his own sounds and those of the sea. She seemed to rub along his side, and Krydike thought he could almost feel her. He felt a brief sexual thrill.
Not nice people, she commented.
Krydike smiled sadly. No, not nice, but they hurt. I would not bother such hermits but for need. He sighed. The world song seems to say they will not help. Nukupai grinned at his pessimism. She changed tempo and whistled softly in an amused tone.
Go below and hear tomorrow's weather. Go below. Prescience. Prescience.
Krydike concentrated to understand her. Why did she speak Trinary, a language almost as difficult for him now as Anglic? There was another speech, subtle and powerful, that they could share now. Why did she remind him of his disability? He shook his head, confused. Nukupai was a figment of his own mind, or at least she was limited to whatever sounds his own voice could create. So how was it she could talk in Trinary at all? There were mysteries still. The deeper he went, the more mysteries there seemed to be.
Go below, deep night diver. Go below. Prescience. Prescience.
He repeated the message to himself. Did she mean that something could be read from the future? That something inevitable was fated to bring the Korank out of their isolation? He was still trying to puzzle out the riddle when he heard the sound of engines. Krydike listened for a few moments, but he didn't need to turn on the sled's hydrophones to recognize the pattern of those motors. Cautiously, tentatively, a tiny spacecraft nosed into the canyon. Sonar swept slowly from one end to another. A searchlight took in the scars in the seabed that the departing streaker had left behind. They scanned bits and pieces of abandoned equipment, and finally came to rest on the little boxy relay and his sled. Krydike blinked in the bright beam. He opened his jaws wide in a smile of greeting, but his voice froze. For the first time in several days, he felt bashful, unable to speak for fear of choking, over even the simplest words, and seeming a fool. The ship's speakers amplified a single happy sigh, elegantly simple.
Krydike!
With a warm pleasure, he recognized that voice. He turned on the sled's motors and cast loose from the relay. As he sped toward the skiff's opening hatch, he called out careful words in Anglic, one at a time.
Hikahi, nice to hear your voice again.
Chapter 91 Tom Orley.
fog swirled over the sea of weeds. That was good, up to a point. It made stealth easier, but it also made it hard to look for traps. Tom searched carefully as he crawled across the last stretch of weeds before the open end of the wrecked cruiser. This patch couldn't be taken underwater, and he didn't doubt those who had taken shelter within the hulk had set up defenses. He found a device only a few meters from the gaping opening. Thin wires were strung from one small hump of vines to the next. Tom inspected the arrangement, then carefully dug below the tripwire and slithered underneath. When he was clear, he scrambled quietly to the edge of the floating ship and rested against the pitted hull. The weed beasties had taken cover during the fighting. They were out again, now that almost all of the combatants were dead. Their frog-like croaks refracted eerily in the noisome vapor. Distantly, Tom heard the rumble of the volcano. His empty stomach growled. It sounded loud enough to rouse the progenitors. He checked his weapon. The Needler had only a few shots left. He had better be right about the number of ETs that had taken shelter aboard this vessel. I'd better be right about a number of things, he reminded himself. I've staked a lot on there being food here as well as the information I need. He closed his eyes in brief meditation, then turned to crouch below the opening. He peeked one eye just past the ragged edge. Three bird-like goobru huddled around a motley array of equipment on the smoke-stained, canted deck. A tiny, inadequate heater held the attention of two, who warmed slender, boned arms over it. The third sat before a battered portable console and squeaked in Galactic Four, a language popular among many avian species.
No signs of humans or their clients, the creature peeped. We have lost our deep search equipment, so we cannot be certain, but we find no sign of Earthlings. We cannot achieve anything more. Come for us.
The radio sputtered.
Impossible to come out of hiding, impossible to squander last resources at this time. You must maintain, you must lie low, you must wait. Wait! We shelter in a hull whose food supply is radioactive. We shelter in a hull whose equipment is ruined. Yet this hull we shelter in is the best still afloat. You must come for us.
Tom cursed silently at the news. So much for eating. The radio operator maintained its protests. The other two goobru listened, shifting their weight impatiently. One of them stamped its clawed feet and turned around suddenly as if to interrupt the radio operator. Its gaze swept past the gap in the hull. Before Tom could duck back, the creature's eyes went wide. It began to point.
A human! Quickly!
Tom shot it in the thorax. Without bothering to watch it fall, he dove through the opening and rolled behind a tilted console. He scuttled to the other end and snapped off two quick shots, just as the second standing goobru tried to fire. A thin flame spat out of a small handgun, searing the already scarred ceiling as the alien shrieked and toppled backward. The Galactic at the radio stared at Tom. It glanced at the radio beside it.
Don't even think it!
Tom squawked in heavily accented Galactic Four. The alien's crest riffled in surprise. It lowered its hands and kept still. Tom rose carefully, never drawing a bead away from the surviving goobru. Drop your weapons belt and stand away from the transmitter. Slowly. Remember, we humans are wolflings. We are feral, carnivorous, and extremely fast. Do not make me eat you. He grinned his broadest grin to display a maximum of teeth. The creature shuddered and moved to obey. Tom reinforced obedience with a growl. Sometimes a reputation as a primitive had its uses. All right, he said, as the alien moved to where he gestured by the gaping hole. Tom kept his gun trained and sat by the radio. The receiver gave out excited twitters. He recognized the model, thank Ifni, and switched it off. "Were you transmitting when your friend here spotted me?" he asked his captive. He wondered if the commander of the hidden Gubru forces had heard the word human. The Galactic's comb fluttered. Its answer was so irrelevant that Tom momentarily wondered if he had totally misphrased the question.
"You must surrender pride," it chanted, puffing its feathers. "All young ones must surrender pride. Pride leads to error. Hubris leads to error. Only orthodoxy can save. We can save. That's enough," Tom snapped. "Save you from heretics. Lead us to the returning progenitors. Lead us to the ancient masters. Lead us to the rule givers. Lead us to them. They expect to return to the paradise they decreed when they long ago departed. They expect paradise and would be helpless before such as the Sorrow or the Tandu or the Thenanin or..."
"Thenanin. That's what I want to know. Are the Thenanin still fighting? Are they powers in the battle?"
Tom swayed with the intensity of his need to know.
"Or the Dark Brothers. They will need protection until they are made to understand what terrible things are being done in their name. Orthodoxies broken, heresies abounding. Lead us to them. Help us cleanse the universe. Your rewards will be great, your modifications small, your indenture short. Stop it!"
Tom felt the strain and exhaustion of the last few days rise in a boiling rage. Next to the Sorrow and Tandu, the Gubru had been among humanity's worst persecutors. He had had all he was about to take from this one.
"Stop it, and answer my questions."
He fired at the floor near the alien's feet. It hopped in surprise, wide-eyed. Tom fired twice more. The first time, the Gubru danced away from a ricochet. The second time, it winced as the needler misfired and jammed. The Galactic peered at him, then squawked joyfully. It spread its feathered arms wide and unsheathed long talons. For the first time, it said something direct and intelligible.
"Now you shall talk, impertinent, half-formed, masterless upstart!"
It charged, screaming. Tom dove to one side as the shrieking avian screeched past him. Slowed by hunger and exhaustion, he couldn't prevent one razor-sharp claw from passing through his wetsuit and ripping his side along one rib. He gasped and stumbled against a blood-stained wall as the Gubru turned around to renew the attack. Neither of them even considered the handguns that lay on the floor. Depleted and slippery, the weapons weren't worth the gamble to stoop and retrieve them.
"Where are the dolphins?"
the Gubru squawked as it danced back and forth.
"Tell me, or I shall teach you respect for your elders the hard way."
Tom nodded. "Learn to swim, bird brain, and I'll take you to them." The Gubru's talons spread again. It shrieked and charged. Tom summoned his reserves. He leapt into the air and met the creature's throat with a savage kick. The shriek was cut off abruptly, and he felt its vertebrae snap as it went down, sliding along the damp deck to fetch up at the wall in a heap. Tom landed stumbling beside it. His eyes swam. Breathing heavily with hands on his knees, he looked down at his enemy.
"I told you we were wolflings," he muttered.
When he could, he walked unsteadily to the ragged tear in the side of the ship and leaned on the curled and blackened lower edge, staring out at the drifting fog. All he had left were his mask, his freshwater still, his clothes, and, oh yes, the nearly worthless hand weapons of the Gubru. And the message bomb, of course. The weight pressed against his midriff. "I've put off a decision long enough," he decided. While the battle lasted, he could pretend he was searching for answers. Maybe he had been procrastinating, though. I wanted to be sure. I wanted to know the trick had a maximum chance of working. For that to happen, there had to be Thenanin. I met that scout. The Gubru mentioned Thenanin.
Do I have to see their fleet to guess there are still some in the battle above? He realized there was another reason he had been putting the decision off. Once I set it off, Crydike and Jillian are gone. There's no way they'll be able to stop for me. I was to get back to the ship on my own, if at all. While fighting on the weeds, he had kept hoping to find a working vessel, anything that could fly him home, but there were only wrecks. He sat down heavily with his back to the cool metal and drew out the message bomb. Do I set it off? The seahorse was his plan. Why was he out here, far from Jillian, at home, but to find out if it would work? Across the blood-smeared deck of the alien cruiser, his gaze fell on the Gubru radio. You know, he told himself, there is one more thing I can do, even if it means I'll be putting myself right in the middle of a bullseye. At least it'll give Jill and the others all I know. And maybe it'll accomplish more than that. Tom summoned the strength to stand up one more time. Ah, well, he thought as he staggered to his feet. There's no food anyway. I might as well go out in style. Part 9. Ascent. Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. A. Tennyson. Chapter 92. Denny and Saud.
It's the longer way, Denny. Are you sure we shouldn't just cut southwest?
Saud swam alongside the sled, keeping pace fairly easily. Every few strokes, he glided smoothly to the surface to blow, then rejoined his companion without breaking stride.
I know it would be faster, Saud, Denny answered without looking up from her sonar display.
She was careful to skirt far from any metal mounds. It was in this area that the killer weed grew. Toshio's story about his encounter with the deadly plant had terrified her, and she was determined to give the unfamiliar mounds a wide berth.
Then why are we returning to Streaker's old site before heading south?
For several reasons, Denny answered. First of all, we know this part of the route, having been over it before, and the path from the old site to the seahorse is straight south, so there's less chance of getting lost. Saud snickered, unconvinced.
And?
And this way we'll stand a chance of finding Hikahi. My guess is she may be nosing around the old site about now.
Did Jillian ask you to look for her?
Yeah, Denny lied. Actually, she had her own reasons for wanting to find Hikahi. Denny was afraid of what Toshio intended to do. It was possible that he meant to delay leaving the island until Streaker's preparations were finished, and it was too late for Takata Jim to interfere. Of course, by then, it would be too late for him to rejoin the ship via sled. In that case, the skiff would be Toshio's only chance. She had to find Hikahi before Jillian did. Jillian might decide to send the skiff after Tom Orley instead of Toshio. She knew she wasn't thinking things out and felt a little guilty about her decision, but if she could lie to one dolphin, she could lie to another. Chapter 93. Takata Jim and Metz. The former vice captain tossed his head and gnashed his teeth as he contemplated the latest sabotage.
I will string their entrails from the forest branches, he hissed.
The heavy Waldo arms of his armored spider whined. Ignacio Metz stared up at the thin, almost invisible wires that formed a tight tracery over the longboat, holding it to the ground. He blinked, trying to follow the trail of fibers into the forest. Metz shook his head.
Are you sure you're not overreacting, Vice Captain? It seems to me the boy was only trying to make sure we didn't take off before we agreed to.
Takata Jim whirled to glare down on the human.
And have you suddenly changed your mind, Dr. Metz? Do you now think we should let the lunatic woman who now controls Streaker send our crewmates out to certain death?
No, of course not. Metz shrank back from the dolphin officer's rancor.
We should persevere, I agree. We must try to make our offer of compromise to the Galactics, but...
But what? Metz shrugged uncertainly.
I just don't think you should blame Toshio for doing his job.
Takata Jim's jaws clapped together like a gunshot, and he caused the spider to advance upon Metz, stopping less than a meter from the nervous man.
You think! You think! Of all comedies, that one tops all. You, who have the arrogance to suppose his wisdom exceeded the councils of Earth, who brought pet monsters amongst an already fragile crew, who deceived himself into thinking all was well, and ignored danger signs when his wisdom was needed by his desperate clients. Yes, Ignacio Metz, tell me how you think.
Takata Jim snorted in derision.
But we... You and I agreed on nearly everything. My Gene Grant Stenos were your most loyal supporters. They're the only ones who stood by you.
Your Stenos were not Stenos. They were benighted, erratic creatures who did not belong on this mission. I used them as I've used you. But don't class me with your monsters, Metz.
Stunned, Metz sagged back against the hull of the longboat. From nearby came sounds of returning machines. With a withering glance, Takata Jim warned the human to be silent. Srikapal's spider pushed through the foliage.
The fibers lead to the pool, the Finn announced. His anglic was almost too high-pitched for Metz to follow. They go below and wrap around the drill tree shaft.
You cut them?
Yes,
the Neofen tossed its head. Takata Jim nodded.
Dr. Metz, please prepare the Kikwi. They are our second greatest trade item, and must be ready for inspection by whichever race we contact.
Where are you going now?
Metz asked.
You don't want to know.
Metz saw Takata Jim's determined expression. Then he noted the three Stenos. Their eyes gleamed with an eager madness.
You've been goading them in primal, he gasped. I can tell. You've taken these Fen over the edge. You're going to make them homicidals.
Takata Jim sighed.
I will wrestle with my conscience later, Dr. Metz. In the meantime, I will do what I must to save the ship and our mission. Since a sane dolphin cannot kill human beings, I needed insane dolphins.
The three Stenos grinned at Metz. He looked at their eyes in terror and listened to their feral clickings.
You're mad,
he whispered. No, Dr. Metz, Takata Jim shook his head pityingly.
You are mad. These Fen are mad. I am only acting as a desperate and dedicated human being might act, criminal or patriot. It's a matter of opinion, but I am sentient.
Metz's eyes were wide.
You can't take back to Earth anyone who knows...
He paled and turned to run for the airlock. Takata Jim did not have to give the order. From Srikapal's spider, a burst of blue light lanced out. Ignacio Metz sighed and fell to the muddy ground just outside the longboat's hatch. He stared up at Srikapal like a father betrayed by a son he had doted on. Takata Jim turned to his crew, hiding the nauseated feeling that churned within him. Find, find, find and kill. Kill, soft-skinned, human, hairy ape. I wait, wait, here, wait here. The Fen gave out a shrill assent in unison, and turned as one to go crashing back into the forest, heavy manipulator arms brushing aside saplings like twigs. The man groaned. Takata Jim looked down at him and considered putting him out of his misery. He wanted to, but he couldn't bring himself to do direct violence against a human being. Just as well, he thought, there are still repairs to do. I must be ready when my monsters return. Takata Jim stepped daintily over the supine human and climbed into the airlock.
Dr. Metz?
Toshio pulled the wounded man to one side and lifted his head. He whispered urgently as he applied a spray ampule of painkiller to the geneticist's neck.
Dr. Metz, can you hear me?
Metz blearily looked up at the young man.
Toshio? My boy, you've got to get away. Takata Jim has sent... I know, Dr. Metz, I was hiding in the bushes when they shot you.
Then you heard, he sighed.
Yes, sir.
And you know what a fool I've been.
Now's not the time for that, Dr. Metz. We've got to get you away. Charlie Dart's hiding nearby. I'll go fetch him now while the Stenos are searching another part of the island.
Metz clutched Toshio's arm.
They're hunting for him, too. I know. And you've never seen a more stunned chimp. He honestly believed they'd never think he helped me. Let me go get him, and we'll move you away from here.
Metz coughed, and red foam appeared on his lips. He shook his head.
No, like Victor Frankenstein, it seems I am murdered by my own hubris. Leave me. You must go to your sled and depart.
Toshio grimaced.
Their first stop was the pool, Dr. Metz. I followed and saw them sink my sled. I ran ahead then to chase the Kikui off the island. Denny taught me their panic signal, and they split like crazed lemmings when I called it out, so at least they're safe from the Stenos.
Not Stenos, Metz corrected.
Demenso Cetus Metzi, I should think. Metz's mad dolphins. You know, I think I'm the first dolphin-perpetrated homicide, and...
He brought his fist to his mouth and coughed again. Metz looked at the red spittle in his hand, then up at Toshio.
We were going to give the Kikui to the Galactics, you know. I wasn't happy, but he convinced me.
Takata Jim?
Yes. Didn't think offering the location of the derelict fleet would be enough. He's got tapes?
Toshio felt stunned.
But how?
Metz wasn't listening. He seemed to be fading fast.
Didn't think would be enough to win Streaker's freedom, so we'd give them the aboriginals as well.
The man grabbed feebly at Toshio's arm.
Don't let the fanatics have them. They're so promising. Must have kind patrons. Maybe the Linton or Cynthians.
We're not suited.
We'd make them caricatures of ourselves. We'd...
The geneticist sagged. Toshio waited with him. It was all he could do for the man. Metz roused once more a minute later. He stared up without seeing.
Takata Jim,
he gasped.
I never thought of it before. Why, he's exactly what we've been looking for. I never realized, but he's not a dolphin. He's a man. Who in the world would have thought?
His voice faded into a rattle. His eyes rolled upward. Toshio found no pulse. He lowered the corpse to the ground and slipped back into the forest.
Metz is dead.
he told Charles Dart. The chimp looked out from the bushes. The whites of his eyes shone.
But that's homicide, I know.
Toshio nodded, sympathizing with Charles Dart. The one standard technique of uplift humans had taken unmodified from the Galactics was to ingrain a revulsion of patron murder in their clients. Hugh thought it particularly hypocritical, considering man's liberal record in other areas. Still,
then they won't think twice about shooting you and me.
Toshio shrugged.
What are we gonna do?
Charlie had dropped all professorial mannerisms. He looked to Toshio for guidance. He's the adult and I'm the kid, Toshio thought bitterly. It should be the other way around. No, that's foolish. Age or patron-client status has nothing to do with it. I'm military. Keeping us alive is my job. He kept his nervousness hidden.
We'll do as we have done, Dr. Dart. We've got to harass them and keep them from taking off as long as possible.
Dart blinked a few times, then protested.
But we'll have no way off then. Can't you get Streaker to come for us? If it turns out to be at all possible, I'm sure Jillian will try to make arrangements, but you and I are expendable now.
Try to understand that, Dr. Dart. We're soldiers. They say there's a kind of satisfaction in sacrificing oneself for others. I guess it's true. Otherwise, there wouldn't ever be legends.
The chimp tried to believe. His hands fluttered.
If they get back to Earth, they'll tell about what we did, won't they?
Toshio smiled.
You bet.
Charlie looked at the ground for a moment. In the distance, they could hear the Stenos crashing through the forest.
Toshio, there's something you ought to know.
What is it, Dr. Dart?
You remember that thing I wanted to make them wait a few hours for before taking off?
Your experiment. Yes, I remember.
Well, the instruments I left aboard Streaker will take the data, so the info will get home even if I don't.
Hey, that's great, Dr. Dart. I'm happy for you. Toshio knew what that meant to the chimp scientist. Charlie smiled weakly.
Yeah, well, it's too late to stop it from happening, so I figure you ought to know so it doesn't surprise you.
Something about the way he said it made Toshio feel uneasy.
Tell me, he said.
Charlie looked at his watch.
The robot will be where I want it in 80 minutes.
He glanced up at Toshio a little nervously.
Then my bomb goes off.
Toshio fell back against the bole of a tree.
Oh, great. That's all we need. I was gonna tell Takata Jim just before so we could hover when it exploded,
Charlie explained sheepishly.
I wouldn't worry too much, though. I looked over Denny's map of the cavern below the island. I'd say there's at least even money the mound won't fall in, but, you know.
He spread his hands. Toshio sighed. They were going to die anyway. Fortunately, this latest twist didn't seem to have any cosmic implications.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 11. Cassette 11, Side 2.
Chapter 94. Streaker.
We're ready. He made the announcement quite matter-of-factly.
Jillian looked up from the holo display. Hannah Suessi gave Jillian a two-fingered salute from the door jam. Light from the bright hallway cast a stark trapezoid onto the floor of the dimly lit room.
The impedance matchings? He asked.
All darn near perfect. In fact,
When we get back to Earth, I'm going to suggest we buy a bunch of old hulls from the Thenanin to refit all Snarks with. We'll be slow, doubly so, because of all the water in the Central Bay, but Streaker will lift, fly, and warp, and it'll take a hell of a punch to pound through the outer shell. Jillian put one foot on the desk.
There's still a lot of punch out there, Hannes.
He'll fly. As for the rest, the engineer shrugged. The only constraint I'd suggest is that you let the engineering staff get an hour or so under sleep machines, if you don't want a sagging on takeoff. And other than that, it's up to you now, Madame Captain. He stopped her before she could speak. And don't go looking to us for any advice either, Jillian. You've been doing too good a job so far. Neither Tish nor I are going to say anything but aye, aye, sir, and jump when you say so. Jillian closed her eyes and nodded.
All right,
she said softly. Hannes looked through the open door from her office to Jillian's laboratory. He knew about the ancient cadaver. He had been there to help Tom Orley bring it back to the ship. Glimpsing a silhouette suspended within a glass case, he shivered and turned away. Jillian's holo display showed a small ping-pong ball-sized representation of Kithrop and a scattering of small BBs as the planet's moons. Two clusters of blue and red dots were accompanied by tiny computer code letters suspended in space. "Don't seem like too many of the nasty buggers are left," Suessi commented.
"Those are just the ships in nearby space. An expanded view about a cubic astron shows two still substantial galactic squadrons. And we can't actually identify the fleets from neutrino fluxes, of course, but the battle computer assigns colors on the basis of movement, and they're still changing alliances out there. Also, there's a plethora of survivors hiding out on the moons."
Uessi pursed his lips. Almost, he asked the question that was on everyone's mind, but he bit it back. Jillian answered anyway.
"There's still been no word from Tom."
She looked at her hands.
"Until now, we didn't really have any use for the information, but..."
He paused. "But now we've got to know whether taking off would be suicide." Duessi finished her thought. He noticed Jillian was studying the display again. "You're trying to figure it out for yourself, aren't you?" Jillian shrugged.
"Go get that hour, Hannes, or 3 or 10. Tell your friend to take their naps at their stations, and toggle their sleep machines to the bridge."
He frowned as she looked at the drifting dots.
"I may be wrong. We may wind up choosing the lesser evil, hiding down here until our gums start turning blue from metal poisoning. Or we starve. But I have a feeling, a hunch, we may have to act soon."
She shook her head. "What about Tosho and Hikaki and the others?" Jillian did not answer. No answer was necessary. After a moment, Suessi turned and left. He closed the door behind him. Dots. No more could be resolved by Streaker's passive sensors than drifting dots that occasionally came together in sparkling swarms and separated smaller in number. The battle computer went over the patterns and drew tentative conclusions, but the answer she needed was never there.
Would the surviving fleets be indifferent to the sudden reappearance of a long-lost Thenanin cruiser, or would they join forces to swat it out of the sky?
The decision lay with her. Never had Jillian felt so alone.
"Where are you, boy? You live, I know. I can feel your distant breath. What are you doing right now?"
To her left, a green light started flashing.
Yes, she told the calmly.
Dr. Baskin?
It was the voice of Wanasetti, calling from the bridge.
Hikahi calls. She is at the relay, and she has Crydike.
Put her through. There was a hiss as the operator raised the gain on the attenuated signal.
Jillian, is that you? Yes, Hikahi. Thank God. Are you all right? And Crydike's still at the relay? We are both quite well, Life Cleaner. From what the Fen on the bridge tell us, you don't seem to need us there at all. They're damned patron-sucking liars, and I wouldn't trade a one of them away for my left arm. Listen, we're missing 5 crew Fen. You should be warned. 2 are atavistic and highly dangerous.
The line hissed for a long moment. Then,
all are accounted for, Jillian,
came the reply at last.
4 of them are dead.
Jillian covered her eyes.
Dear Lord. Kipiro is with us,
Hikahi answered her unasked question.
Poor Aki,
Jillian sighed.
Send word to Calathea that he did his duty. Kipiro says he was defiant and sentient till the end.
Jillian did not like the implication of Hikahi's message.
Hikahi, you're in command now. We need you back here now. I am this instant officially handing over. Don't, Jillian,
the fluting voice interrupted.
Please, not yet. There are still things to be done with the skiff. Those on the island must be recovered, and the Kikui volunteers.
I'm not sure we'll have time, Hikahi. The words were bitter as she spoke them. She thought of bright, ever self-deprecating Denny Sudman, of the erudite Saud, and Toshio, so very young and noble.
Has Tatam called? Is there an emergency?
Neither yet, but
then what?
She couldn't explain. She tried in trinary. What a piercing sound I hear. The peal of bugles, engines rising, the tears of love abandoned. Soon, so very soon. There was a long silence from the skiff. Then, it was not Hikahi's voice, but Crydike's that answered. In his repetitious, simply phrased trinary, there was something Jillian could only catch a hint of, something deep and a little eerie. Sounds, all sounds, answer something, acts, all acts, make sounds, but duty, all duty, calls silently. Call silently. Jillian didn't breathe as she listened to Crydike's last note fall away. Her spine was chilled.
Bye, Jillian, Hikahi said. You do what you have to. We'll be back quick as we can, but don't wait for us. Hikahi!
Jillian reached for the comm link. But the carrier wave cut off before she could say another word. Chapter 95. Toshio.
Both airlocks are bolted from the inside,
Toshio panted when he returned to the hiding place.
Looks like we try it your way.
Charles Dart nodded and led him to the impulse thrusters at the stern of the small spacecraft. Twice they had hidden themselves by climbing tall trees as patrolling Stenos passed below. It seemed not to occur to the mad Fen to look above for their quarry, but Toshio knew they'd be deadly if they ever caught him and Charlie in the open. Charlie removed the rear cover to the maintenance bay between the engines.
I got in by crawling between the feed lines. Over there. till I reached the access plate in that bulkhead.
He pointed. Toshio peered into the maze of pipes. He looked back at Dart, amazed.
No wonder nobody expected a stowaway. Is this how you got into the armory as well? By climbing through the ducts where no human could fit?
The planetologist nodded.
I guess you can't go in with me. That means I gotta get the little critters out by myself, right?
Toshio nodded.
I think they're in the aft hold. Here's the voter.
He handed over the translator. It looked like a large medallion hanging from a neck chain. All Neo-chimps knew about voters, since they generally had trouble talking until the age of 3. Charlie slipped it over his head. He started to climb into the small opening, but stopped and looked sidelong at the MIDI.
Say, Toshio, imagine this was one of those 20th century zoo ships, and those were a bunch of pre-sentient chimps in the hold of a clipper ship, or whatever they used back then, on their way from Africa to some laboratory or circus. Would you have snuck in to rescue them?
Toshio shrugged.
I don't honestly know, Charlie. I'd like to think I would have, but I really don't know what I'd have done.
The Neo-chimp met the human's eyes for a long instant. Then he grunted.
Okay, you guard the rear.
He took a boost from Toshio and squirmed into the mechanical maze. Toshio squatted beneath the thruster tubes and listened to the forest. While Charlie struggled to get the inner access plate off, he made what felt like a terrible racket. Then it stopped. Toshio slid into the forest to make a cautious circuit of the immediate area. From crashing sounds up in the direction of the Kikui village, he guessed the Stenos were amusing themselves with a destructive spree. He hoped none of the little natives had come back yet to witness, or worse, be caught in the violence. He returned to the longboat and looked at his watch. 17 minutes until the bomb went off. They were cutting it close. He reached into the maintenance area and spent a few minutes twiddling with some of the valves, spoiling their settings. Of course, Takata Jim didn't need the thrusters at all. If he was indeed refueled, he could take off on gravitics. Leaving the access panel loose would decrease the boat's aerodynamic stability, but even that effect would be slight. Longboats like these were built rugged. He stopped and listened. The rampage through the forest was heading this way again. The Fen were on their way back.
Hurry up, Charlie.
He fingered the grip of his holster needler, not certain he could aim well enough to hit the vulnerable patches where the dolphins were unprotected by the metal-sided spiders.
Come on!
There came a series of small, wet, slapping sounds from within the cavity. Intermittent squeaks echoed from the narrow confines, and then he saw a pair of widely splayed, green-finned hands. They were followed by the head of a rather distressed-looking Kikui. The aboriginal scuttled through the inner panel and crept through the maze of pipes, until it leapt into Toshio's arms. Toshio had to peel the frightened creature loose and put it down in order to reach for the next one. The little Kikui were making a fearful racket, squeaking dolefully. Finally, all four were out. Toshio peered inside and saw Charles Dart trying to replace the inner panel.
Never mind that,
Toshio hissed.
I gotta. Takata Jim will notice the change in air pressure on his panel. It's only luck he hasn't yet.
Come on, there.
He heard the whine of Waldo motors and crushed vegetation.
They're here. I'm going to draw them away from you. Good luck, Charlie.
Wait!
Toshio crawled a few meters into the shrubbery so they would not guess where he came from. Then, from a crouch start, he ran.
There, there, whaler, icky net man, tuna follower, there, kill, there.
The Stenos squawked from very close nearby,
Toshio dove behind an olienut tree as bolts of blue death sizzled overhead. The Kikui screamed and scattered into the forest. Toshio rolled to his feet and ran, trying to keep the tree between him and his pursuers. He heard sounds to the left and right as the Fen moved quickly to surround him. His dry suit slowed him down as he tried to reach the shore cliffs before the circle was closed. Chapter 96. Tom Worley. He spent a while listening to the radio, but although he recognized a few species types in the voices, so much of the traffic was intercomputer that there was little to be learned that way. All right, he told himself. Let's work out the proper phrasing. This had better be good. Chapter 97. The Skiff. Denny stumbled over the words she had so carefully prepared. She tried to rephrase her arguments, but Ikahi stopped her.
Dr. Sudman, you needn't persist. Our next stop is the island, anyway. We'll pick up Toshio if he hasn't left already, and perhaps we'll deal with Takata Jim as well. We'll be on our way as soon as Crydike finishes.
Denny exhaled all of her remaining tension. It was out of her hands, then. The professionals would take care of things. She might as well relax.
How long?
Ikahi tossed her head.
Crydike doesn't expect to do any better this time than last. It shouldn't take long. Why don't you and Sao go and rest in the meantime?
Denny nodded and turned to find some space to stretch out in the tiny hold. Sao swam alongside.
Say, Denny, as long as we're trying to relax, want to trade backgrounds?
Denny laughed.
Sure, Sao. Just don't get carried away, okay?
Crydike tried to reason with them one more time. We are desperate, as you once were. We offer hope to little unfinished ones on this very world. Hope to grow unbent. Our enemies will harm you as well in time. Help us. The static pulsed and throbbed in response. It carried a partly psychic feeling of closedness, of pressure and molten heat. It was a claustrophilic song, in praise of rough, hard stone and flowing metal.
Cheese. Peas. Relief. Isolation.
Silence fell suddenly with a squeal of tortured machinery. The old robot, which had so long hung 2 kilometers down the narrow drill tree shaft, had been destroyed. Crydike clicked a familiar phrase in trinary. It is, that is. He was tempted to enter the dream again, but there was on this level of reality no time for such things. This level of reality was where duty lay, for the moment. Later, perhaps. Later he would visit Nukupai again. Perhaps she would show him the untellable things that she heard through the vague avenues of prescience. He headed back to the airlock of the tiny spaceship. Ikahi, seeing him approach, started warming up the engines. Chapter 98. Tom Worley. A small group of dolphins spotted a few hundred pactars north of this location. They were moving north quite rapidly. They may have come this way to see what all the fighting was about. Hurry! Now is the time to strike! Tom clicked off the receiver. His head hurt from the concentration it took to speak Galactic Pen rapidly. Not that he expected the Brothers of the Night to believe his was the voice of one of their missing scouts. That didn't matter to his plan. All he wanted to do was stir up their interest before the final jab. He switched frequency and pursed his lips in preparation to speaking Galactic 12. Actually, this was fun. It distracted him from his exhaustion and hunger, and satisfied his aesthetic sense, even if it did mean everyone and his client would be down here shortly, all looking for him. Ha-ha, warriors! Ha-ha, ab Klepko, ab Puber, ab Soro, ab Ho! Inform the Soro fleet mistress we have news! Tom chuckled as he thought of a pun that could only be phrased in Galactic 12, and which, nevertheless, he was sure the Soro would never get. Chapter 98 Jillian. Something was making the fleets shift all of a sudden. Small squadrons raveled off the battered fleets and joined tiny groups from Kithrop's moons, all heading toward the planet. As they merged, the groups swirled about and tiny explosions took the place of individual lights. What in the world was going on? Whatever it was, Jillian felt a glimmer of opportunity.
Dr. Baskin! Jillian!
Bishop's voice came over the comm speaker.
We're getting radio traffic from the planet's surface again. It's from a single transmitter, but it keeps putting out stuff in different galactic languages. Yet I swear they all sound like one voice.
He leaned forward and touched a switch.
I'm on my way up, Tish. Please call half of the off-duty shift to stations. We'll let the others rest a while longer.
He switched off the unit. Oh, Tom, she thought. He hurried out the door. Why this? Couldn't you have come up with anything more elegant, anything less desperate? Of course he couldn't, she chided herself as she ran down the hallway. Come on, Jill. The least you can do is not be a nag. In moments, she was on the bridge, listening for herself. Chapter 100 Toshio. Cornered, Toshio couldn't even climb a tree. They were too close and would be on him the instant they heard him move. He could hear them as they spiraled closer, tightening the noose. Toshio clutched his needler and decided he had better attack first. Before they were close enough to support each other. It would be a small handgun against armored machines and high-powered lasers, and he was no marksman like Tom Orley. In fact, he had never fired at a sentient being before, but it beat waiting here. He crouched and began to crawl to his right, toward the shoreline. He tried not to snap any twigs, but a minute after leaving his hiding place, he flushed some small animal, which fled noisily through the bushes. Immediately, he heard the noise of approaching mechanicals. Toshio slithered quickly under a thick bush, only to emerge facing the broad footpad of a spider.
Gotcha, gotcha.
There was a squeal of triumph. He looked up to meet the mad eye of Srikapal. The fin leered as he commanded the spider to lift its leg. Toshio rolled aside as the foot crashed down where his head had been. He reversed direction, avoiding a kick. The mechanical reared back, bringing both front legs into play. Toshio saw no place to turn. He fired a small pistol against the armored belly of the machine, and tiny needles ricocheted harmlessly into the forest. The triumphant whistle was pure primal.
Gotcha.
Then the island began to shake. The ground heaved up and down. Toshio was jounced right and left, and his head hit the loam rhythmically. The spider teetered, then crashed backward into the forest. The shaking accelerated. Toshio somehow rolled over onto his stomach. He fought the oscillations to rise to his knees. There was a crunching sound as two spider riders stumbled into the clearing. One crashed past Toshio in panic. The other, though, saw him and squawked in wrath. Toshio tried to hold out his needler, but the island's trembling began to turn into a list. It became a race between him and the mad dolphin to see who could aim and fire first. Then both of them were staggered by a scream that echoed within their heads.
"Bad, bad ones! Leave us alone!"
It was a roar of rejection that made Toshio moan and grab at his temples. The needler slipped out of his grasp and fell to the rapidly tilting ground. The dolphin whistled shrilly as its spider collapsed in convulsions. It wailed in a foxhole lamentation.
"Sorry, sorry, patron, forgive, forgive."
Toshio stumbled forward.
"Forgiven,"
he managed to say as he hurried past. He couldn't deal with the fin's schizoid conversion.
"Come this way if you can,"
he called back as he tried to make it to the shore. The noise in his head was like an earthquake. Somehow, Toshio managed to stay on his feet and stumble through the forest. When he reached the edge of the mound, the sea was a froth below. Toshio looked right and left and saw no place that looked any better. At that moment, a scream of engines pealed forth. He looked back to see a tornado of broken vegetation fly up from a spot only 100 meters away. The gunmetal gray longboat rose above the rapidly tilting forest. It was surrounded by a glowing nimbus of ionization. Toshio's hackles rose as the island was swept by a throbbing anti-gravity field. The boat turned slowly and seemed to hesitate. Then, with a thunderclap, it speared into the eastern sky. Toshio crouched as the boom whipped at him, tugging at his clothes. There was no time to delay. Either Charles Dart had got away, or he hadn't. Toshio pulled his mask up over his face, held it with one hand, and leapt.
"Ifni's boss," he prayed,
and he fell into the stormy waters. Chapter 101 Galactics. Above the planet, small flotillas of battered warships paused suddenly in their multi-sided butchery. They had left hiding places on Kithrop's tiny moons, gambling all on the chance that the strange radio broadcasts from the planet's northern hemisphere were indeed of human origin. On their way down to Kithrop, the tiny alliances sniped at each other with their waning strength, until a sudden wave of psychic noise hit the entire motley ensemble. It rose from the planet with a power none could have expected, overwhelming psi shields and striking crews temporarily motionless. The ships continued to plunge toward the planet. Their living crews blinked limply, unable to fire their weapons or guide their vessels. If it had been a weapon, the psychic shout would have cleansed half of the ships of their crews. As it was, the mental scream of anger and rejection reverberated within their brains, driving a few of the least flexible completely mad. For long moments, the cruisers drifted out of formation, uncontrolled, downward into the upper fringes of the atmosphere. Finally, the sigh scream began to fade. The grating anger growled and diminished, leaving burning afterimages as the numb crews slowly came to their senses. The Zatini and their clients, having drifted away from the others, looked about and discovered that they had lost their appetite for further fighting. They decided to accept the pointed invitation to depart. Their four ragged ships left Kasthemeni's system as quickly as laboring engines could manage. The J-8-Lek were slow coming around. After succumbing to the numbing mind scream, they drifted in amongst the ships of the Brothers of the Night. The Brothers awakened sooner and used the J-8-Lek for target practice. Sophisticated autopilots brought two Jofer warships to land on the slope of a steaming mountain, far to the south of their original destination. Automatic weapons kept watch for enemies, while the Jofer struggled with their confusion. Finally, as the stunning psychic noise subsided, the crews began to revive and retake control of their grounded ships. The Jofer were almost ready to lift off again and head north to rejoin the fray, when the entire top of their mountain blew away in a column of superheated steam. Chapter 102 Streaker. Jillian stared, slack-jawed, until the grating sounds finally began to fade. She swallowed. Her ears popped, and she shook her head to clear away the numb feeling. Then she saw that the dolphins were staring at her.
"That was awful," she stated. "Is everybody all right?"
Tisht looked relieved.
"We're all fine, Jillian. We detected an extremely powerful psi explosion a few moments ago. It easily pierced our shields and seems to have dazed you for a few minutes. But except for some momentary discomfort, we hardly felt it."
Jillian rubbed her temples.
"Must be my Esper sensitivity that made me susceptible. Let's just hope the ETs don't follow that attack up with another even closer."
She stopped. Tisht was shaking her head.
"Jillian, I don't think it was the ETs. Or if it was, they weren't aiming for us. Instruments indicate that burst came from very close nearby and was almost perfectly tuned not to be received by cetaceans. Your brain is similar to ours, though you only felt it a little. The Wesley reports hardly feeling a thing. But I imagine some of the galactics had a rough time weathering that psi storm."
Jillian shook her head a second time.
"I don't understand." "That makes two of us. But I don't suppose we have to understand. All I can tell you is this. At almost the same time that psi burst went off, there was an intense ground tremor not 200 clicks from here. The crustal waves are only now starting to arrive."
Jillian swam over to Tisht's station in the glassy sphere of Streaker's Bridge. The dolphin lieutenant pointed with her jaw toward a globe model of the planet. Not far from Streaker's position on the globe, a small cluster of flashing red symbols was displayed.
"That's Toshio's island," Jillian said. "Then Charlie did have a spare bomb after all." "Beg pardon?"
Tisht looked confused.
"But I thought Dakota Jim had confiscated..."
"Ship rising," a detection officer announced. "Anti-G and stasis, from the same site as the crust tremors, 150 clicks from here.
Tracking.
Ship is now heading off at Mach 2 due east."
Jillian looked at Tisht. They shared the same thought. Dakota Jim. Jillian saw the question in the dolphin officer's eye.
"We may face a decision shortly. Have his blip follow to see where he's headed, and we'd better start awakening the rest of the off-duty crew."
"Aye, sir, those that managed to remain asleep through the last few minutes."
Tisht turned and relayed the command. A few minutes later, the battle computer began to chatter.
"What now?"
Jillian asked. Bright yellow pinpoints began to glow up and down a long, jagged streak on the globe of Kithrop, starting from the site of Toshio's island.
"Detonations of some sort,"
Tisht commented.
"The computer's interpreting them as bombings, but we've detected no missiles. And why this scattered pattern? The detonations are only occurring along this narrow stripe of longitude."
"More side disturbances," an operator announced.
"Strong, and from numerous sources all on the planet." Jillian frowned.
"Those detonations aren't bombings. I remember seeing that pattern before. That's the boundary of this planetary crustal plate. Those disturbances may be volcanoes." "I'd say it's the locals' way of showing they're unhappy."
Tisht queried confusedly. Jillian's expression was thoughtful, as if she was looking at something very far away.
"I think I'm starting to understand what's been going on. We can thank Crydike for the fact
that the psi disturbances don't affect dolphins, for instance. The dolphin stared at her. Jillian smiled and patted Tish's flank.
Not to worry, Femme Finn. It's a long story, but I'll explain if we have time. I expect the biggest effect all this will have on us is crust quakes. We should be getting some shortly. Will we be able to ride them out down here?
The dolphin lieutenant frowned. The way humans could change mental tracks mid-stride was beyond her comprehension.
Yes, I think so, Jillian. That is, so long as that remains stable.
He gestured through a port toward the sea cliff that loomed over their hybrid ship. Jillian looked up at the hulking mass of rock visible through cracks in the Thenanin armor.
I'd forgotten about that. We'd better keep an eye on it.
He turned back to the holo display, watching the spreading pattern of disturbances.
Come on, Hikahi,
he urged silently.
Pick up Toshio and the others and get back here.
I have to make a decision soon, and you might get back too late. The minutes passed. Several times the water seemed to tremble as a low rumble passed through the seafloor. Jillian watched the blue globe of Kithra. A string of flickering yellow pinpoints spread gradually northward, like an angry wound in the planet's side. Finally, the dots merged with a small group of tiny islands in the northeast quadrant.
That's where Tom is, he remembered.
Suddenly, the comm operator thrashed at his station.
Commander, I'm getting a transmission, and it's in Anglic.
Chapter 103. Tom Orley. He held the microphone awkwardly. It had been designed for alien hands. Tom ran his tongue over his cracked lips. He didn't have time to go over his speech once more. Company would be arriving any moment now. He pressed the transmit lever.
Crydike,
he spoke carefully. Record and replay for Jillian. He'll interpret. He knew every ship in near space was listening to this transmitter by now. Probably a large number were already on their way here. If he composed his new lines properly, he could make sure even more of them came. My direct wire to the ship is broken, he said, and 100 kilometers is a long way to have to carry a message, so I'll risk this new coder, hoping it's not been broken in all the fighting here. That blast was a tissue of fantasies for galactic consumption. Now for the real message. Hidden in context, he had to tell Streaker what he knew.
Jill, our egg hatched, hon, and a zoo spilled out. A zoo of fierce critters. But I came across only one bedraggled sample of the brand we're shopping for. I've heard clues it's still for sale on higher shelves, but those have been just clues. You and H and C are going to have to decide on that basis. Remember when old Jake Demwa took us along with him on that mission to the Central Library on Tanith? Remember what he said about hunches? Tell Crydike about it. It's his decision. But my gut feeling is, follow Jake's advice.
He felt a thickening in his throat. He should cut this off. No sense in letting the ETs zero in too closely.
Jill?
He coughed.
Hun, I'm out of the game now. Get Herbie and the rest of the data to the council. And those abos, too. I've got to believe all this has been worth it.
He closed his eyes and gripped the mic.
When you see old Jake, hoist a glass with him for me, will you?
He wanted to say more, but realized that he was already getting a little too unambiguous. He couldn't afford to let the Galactic's language computers figure out what he was talking about. He pursed his lips and bid adieu in a language designed for such things. Petals floating by, drift
through my woman's hand, as she remembers me. The carrier wave hissed until he cut the circuit. He rose and carried the radio outside. Carefully approaching the edge of an open pool, he dropped the transmitter in. If anyone had locked into a resonance with the crystals in the set, that ET would have to dive for it. He stood there by the pool and watched low clouds roll past, dark and heavy with unspent rain. They'd be arriving any moment. His weapons were at his belt, and his breathing tube, and a full canteen. He was ready for them. He was standing that way, watching and waiting, when the steaming volcano on the horizon began to growl, then cough, then angrily spout bright fireworks into the sky. The bridge was a blur. Jillian's eyes swam, but when she blinked, the tears would not bead and drop away. Her eyes clung to them like precious things.
"Shall we answer?"
Tish spoke softly from next to her. Jillian shook her head. "No," she tried to say, but she could only mouth the word. Telepathically, she sensed the sympathy of those around her. "How can I mourn?" she wondered, "when I can still feel him faintly. He is still alive out there somewhere. How can I mourn?" She felt a swirl of movement as a fin approached cautiously and tried to report to Tish without disturbing her. Jillian pressed her burning eyelids together. The tears flowed at last, in narrow trails down her cheeks. She couldn't reach under her mask to brush them away, so she let them lie. When she opened her eyes, her vision had cleared.
"I heard that, Wattasetti. Which way is Takata Jim headed?"
"Toward the galactic flotillas, Commander, though the fleet seemed to be in chaos. They are boiling every which way after the confusion caused by that psi-burst. A major free-for-all is shaping up above."
"Above Mr. Orley's position."
Jillian nodded.
"We'll wait a little while longer. Go to condition yellow and keep me informed."
Off-duty personnel were called to their posts. Dewesi and Dianidi reported that the engines were warm.
"Last chance, Hikahi," Jillian thought. "Are you coming?"
"Jillian!"
Lucky Ka called. With his harness arm, he pointed out one of the ports.
"The cliff!"
Jillian hurried over and looked where the pilot indicated. The entire mass of rock was trembling. Cracks began to appear in the great wall that towered over Streaker.
"Lift stations," Jillian commanded. "Tisht, take us out of here."
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 11, Star Tide Rising, Cassette 12.
Chapter 104 Galactics. Kul Calambra bowed low before the Soro Kret.
"Have you interpreted the human's broadcast?"
he snapped. The stocky pill bowed again, backing away slightly.
"No, Fleet Mother, not completely. The human spoke in their two doggerel languages, called Anglic and Trinary. We have translation programs for both, of course, but they are so chaotic and contextual, unlike any civilized language." The librarian flinched as Krat hissed at him.
"Have you nothing?"
"Mistress, we think the last part of his message, in the dolphin speech, may be the important part. It might have been a command to his clients, or..."
The librarian piped dismay and dodged back into his station, as a ling plum missed him by inches.
"Hypotheses? Tentative conjectures?"
Krat stormed.
"Even the Tandu boil with excitement and send expedition after futile piddling expedition to the site of the planet's surface from which the message emanated. And we must, perforce, follow, no?"
She stared about. Her crew avoided her gaze.
Has anyone even a hypothesis to explain that Psi assault, which struck a short time ago and seems to have disoriented every sophant in the system? Was that also a chimera of the Earthlings? Are the volcanoes that fill our instruments with static mere trickery?
The crew tried to look simultaneously busy and attentive. No one wanted to risk the ire of the fleet mother. A Paha warrior strode from the office of detection.
Mistress, it announced, we did not notice before because of the volcanoes, but there has been a launching from the planet's surface.
Krat felt a turn of glee. This was what she had been waiting for. Though she had sent ships of her own to the site of the radio messages, she had kept the core of her fleet together.
Diversions! They were all diversions. The radio calls, the Psi attacks, even the volcanoes.
A part of her was curious about how the Earthlings had managed the last two. But that question would be solved when the humans and their clients were captured and interrogated.
The Earthlings waited until much of the battle had moved near their planet, she muttered. And now they make their attempt to escape. Now we must.
Cull Calabra came up to her side and bowed. Mistress, I've done a deep search of the library, and I think I know the source of the Psi and the... The pill's eyes bugged out as Krat stabbed him in the abdomen with her mating claw. Krat stood up, carrying the librarian in the air, then flung his lifeless body over to the wall. She stood over the body, breathing deeply of the death odors. No trouble would come over this killing, at least. The idiotic pill had actually interrupted her. No one would deny that she had been within her rights this time. She sheathed her claw. It had felt good, not quite like mating with a male of her own race, who could fight back in kind, but good.
Tell me about the Earthling ship, she crooned to the Paha.
She noticed it waited a full second after she finished speaking to begin.
Mistress, it said, it is not their main vessel. It appears to be a scout ship of some sort.
Krat nodded.
An emissary? I wondered why they did not try to work out a surrender agreement before this. Move the fleet to intercept this vessel. We must act before the Tandu notice it. Have our new Thenanan allies take the rear. I want them to understand that they are junior partners in this enterprise.
Mistress, the Thenanan have already begun preparations to leave us. They appear to be eager to join the chaos at the planet's surface.
Krat grunted.
Let them. We are even with the Tandu again, and the Thenanin are almost used up anyway. Let them depart. Then we proceed after the scout ship.
She settled back onto the Vlitor cushion and hummed to herself. Soon. Soon. The Masters demanded too much. How could they expect the Acceptor to report specifically when so much was happening? It was beautiful. Everything was going on at once. Sparkling little battles over the planet's surface, bright, hot volcanoes, and that great psychic roar of anger that had poured out of the planet itself only a little while ago. The anger still steamed and spumed. Why were the Masters so uninterested in something so unique? Psi from below a planet's surface? The Acceptor could tell the Tandu so much about that angry voice, but they were only interested in shutting it out. It distracted them and made them feel vulnerable. The Acceptor witnessed it all in bliss until the punishment came again. The Masters applied a neural whip. Its legs jerked at the unpleasant sensation that coursed through its brain. Did it let the punishment alter its behavior this time? The Acceptor considered.
It decided to ignore the pain. Let them cajole and shout. The acceptor was enthralled by the angry voices that churned below, and listened with all its might.
Chapter 105. The Skiff.
What the devil?
Denny was rolled off the dry shelf to splash into the water below. South squawked in confusion as the tiny ship's hold tipped. Then, in addition to the physical tossing, a rolling wave of psychic discomfort began to fill their heads. Denny coughed water and grabbed a wall stanchion. She wanted to cover her ears.
Not again,
she moaned. She tried to use the techniques Toshio had taught her, focusing on her heartbeat to drive out the grinding static in her head. She hardly even noticed when Sao shouted,
"It's them!"
The Finn pressed the hatch button with his beak and sped out into the hallway. He streaked into the tiny control room.
"Crydikey,"
he began, forgetting for a moment that the captain could not understand him.
"It's them, the voices from below."
Crydikey looked back at him, and Sarald realized that the captain already knew. In fact, he seemed hardly surprised. Crydikey crooned a soft melody of acceptance. He appeared content. From the pilot station, Kipiru announced,
"I'm getting neutrinos and anti-G flux. They're coming from dead ahead. A small ship taking off."
Hikaki nodded.
"Probably Takata Jim. I hope Jillian's right that he's been taken care of."
They continued to drive underwater toward the east. About a half hour later, Kipiru shouted again.
"More anti-G! A big ship! Taking off from near to the southwest."
Crydikey's flukes struck the surface of the water. "Up, up, up and look, look." Hikaki nodded to Kipiru.
"Take her up."
The skiff surfaced. Seawater slid in sheets off the ports. They clustered around a southern port and watched as a distant wedge-shaped object erupted from the horizon and lumbered into the sky, slowly gathering speed. They watched as it flew south, passing the speed of sound, finally disappearing into the high clouds. They watched even after Streaker's contrail began to drift and slowly come apart under Kithrip's contrary winds. Part 10. Rapture. They are the lads that always live before the wind. Herman Melville. Chapter 106. Toshio. Toshio swam hard as the swell tried to drag him backward. He fought the current and strove for the open sea. Finally, just as he felt aching arms and legs could do no more, he reached calmer waters. With burning lungs, he turned and watched as the metal mound, now almost 2 kilometers away, sank slowly into its pit. The sinking couldn't go on. The drill tree had not completed its excavations when he and Denny had blown it apart. The island would probably settle until the shaft was plugged. Dull detonations groaned on all sides of him. Toshio treaded water and looked around. On islands in all directions, trees swayed, and not from the wind. In the distance, he saw at least 3 roiling clouds of steam and smoke rise from boiling patches in the sea. There was a growling of subsea quakes. All this because of one little bomb? In spite of all he had been through, Toshio calmly wondered about the cause of it all. With nothing left to do but choose the manner of his dying, he felt queerly liberated. What if the bomb released a vein of magma, Toshio wondered.
If a volcano appeared anywhere, I'd think it would be in that drill tree shaft. But I guess the island's plugging it. The metal mound that had been his home for 2 weeks seemed to have stopped sinking. A few treetops waved above the water. Toshio wondered about the fate of Charles Dart. He couldn't imagine the chimpanzee swimming very far. Perhaps it was just as well. At least Charlie had had a clean exit. Toshio felt a bit better having rested. He began swimming again for the open sea. About 20 minutes later, there came another low rumbling. He looked around just in time to see the distant mound rocked by a terrific explosion. Dirt and vegetation flew in all directions. The mound itself heaved upward, almost out of the water, split apart, then fell back into a cloud of steam. Chapter 107 Takata Jim.
Calling battle fleet. Calling the battle fleet ahead. This is Lieutenant Takata Jim of the Terrigan Survey Service. I wish to negotiate. Please respond.
The receiver was silent. Takata Jim cursed. The radio must work. He had taken it from Thomas Orley's sled, and that human always maintained his equipment. Why weren't the Galactics answering? The longboat was designed to be run by more than one person. The sudden and unexpected disaster at the island had forced him to abandon his Stenos. Now he had no one to help him. He had to juggle two or three jobs at once. He watched the tactics display. A cluster of yellow lights were heading his way from Galactic North. It was a paltry flotilla compared with the great armadas that had come sweeping into the system only weeks ago. But it was still an awesome array of firepower. They were heading right for him. Everywhere, all was chaos. The planet was pockmarked with energy releases, boiling steam tornadoes where volcanoes emptied into the sea. And above the planet's northern hemisphere, a free-for-all battle was going on. Takata Jim increased the scale on his display and saw another fleet. It, too, had just started turning toward him. The ether was filled with a roar of voices. AM, FM, PCM. Every spot on the dial took part in the confusion. Could that explain why nobody seemed to hear him? No. The Galactics had sophisticated computers. It had to be his own equipment. There had been no time to check it all before taking off. Takata Jim nervously watched the map. He was flying into a pod of tiger sharks, hoping to negotiate Streaker's protection and eventual release. But he remembered the look on Jillian Baskin's face a week before, when he had suggested giving the ETs everything they wanted. Metz had supported him then, but the expression on the woman's face came to mind now. She had looked at him pityingly and told him that fanatics never worked that way.
"They'll take all we have, thank us politely, and then boil us in oil," she had commented.
Takata Jim tossed his head. "I don't believe it. Besides, anything is better than what she plans." He watched the tactics hollow. The first fleet was only 100,000 clicks away now. The computer gave him data on the ships at last. They were Sorrow battlecruisers. Sorrow. Takata Jim tasted bile from his first stomach. All the stories he had heard about them came to mind. What if they shoot first? What if they're not even interested in prisoners? He looked at his own battle controls. The armament of the longboat was pitiful, but a claw of his harness reached over to flick on the arming switch, just for the small comfort it gave. Chapter 108 Streaker.
Now both of the larger fleets turn toward Takata Jim.
Jillian nodded.
Keep me informed, Watasetti.
She turned.
Tisht, how long can we stay hidden by these tectonic disturbances?
Our anti-G's been detectable for 5 minutes, Jillian,
I don't think we can put off energy detection much longer by flying over volcanoes. If we're to make a break for it, we've got to gain altitude. We're being scanned at long range, the detector operator snapped. A couple of ships from that battle over Orly's position are curious.
That's it, then, Tisch commented. We go for it.
Jillian shook her head.
Buy me 5 more minutes, Tisch. I don't care about the stragglers up north. Keep me hidden from the main fleets just a little while longer.
Tisch whirled through the oxywater, leaving a trail of bubbles.
Lucky Ka, steer south by southwest toward that new volcano.
Jillian stared intently at the display. A tiny blue speck showed the longboat flying toward a mass of over 30 much larger dots.
Come on, Takata Jim,
Jillian murmured to herself.
I thought I had you figured out. Prove me right.
There hadn't been a sound on the radio from the renegade lieutenant. Toshio must have done his job and sabotaged the sets on the island. The blue speck drew within 100,000 kilometers of the enemy.
Telemetry! Takata Jim's armed his weapons,
Watasetti announced. Jillian nodded.
I knew it. The fellow's almost human. He'd have to have a stronger personality than I'd ever expected. Not to do that, just for the security blanket effect. As pointless as it seemed, who would go to face an enemy with his safeties on? Now, just a little closer.
Jillian! The detector officer cried. I don't believe it. Takata Jim has... Jillian smiled a little sadly.
Let me guess. Our brave vice captain is firing on the entire battle fleet.
Tisch and Watasetti turned to look at her wide-eyed. She shrugged.
Come now. For all his faults, no one ever said Takata Jim wasn't brave.
She grinned to hide her own nervousness.
Get ready, everybody.
Chapter 109 Takata Jim. Takata Jim shrieked and grabbed at the toggle switch. It didn't work. The fire controls were activating without his orders. Every few seconds, a shudder passed through the little ship as a small seeker missile launched from the single torpedo tube. Small bursts of antimatter erupted from the longboat's nose, automatically aimed at the nearest alien vessel. In a lucky shot, the lead Soro ship blossomed open like a fiery flower unfolding. The sheer surprise of the attack had overcome defenses designed to withstand Nova heat. He cursed and tried the override. It, too, had no effect. As the Soro fleet began firing in return, Takata Jim wailed and swerved the little scout into a wild series of evasive maneuvers. With the dolphin's natural three-dimensional sense, he whirled off in a high G gyration, threading salvos that passed chillingly close. There was only one thing to do, only one possible source of succor. Takata Jim sent the scout streaking toward the second battle fleet. They must have witnessed his attack. They would think him an ally if he survived long enough to reach them. He sped out into space, chased by a herd of behemoths that turned and lumbered after him. Chapter 110 Streaker.
Now, Jillian?
Almost, dear. Another minute.
Those ships from the north seem to have decided. Several of them are turning this way. Correction, the whole skirmish is heading southward, toward us.
Jillian couldn't make herself feel too bad about drawing fire away from Tom's position. He was only returning his favor, after all.
All right, you choose a trajectory. I want to head out east on the ecliptic, just as soon as that second fleet finishes turning toward the longboat.
Tisch warbled an impatient sigh.
Aye, sir.
She swam to the pilot's position and conferred with Lucky Ka. Chapter 111 Tom. He raised his head above the surface of the pool where he had taken refuge. Where had everybody gone all of a sudden? Minutes ago, the sky had been ablaze with pyrotechnics. Burning ships were falling out of the sky right and left. Now he caught sight of a few stragglers, high in the distant sky, speeding southward. It took him a moment to come up with a guess. Thanks, Jill, he thought. Now, give them hell for me. Chapter 112 Takata Jim. Takata Jim spluttered in frustration. He was so busy there wasn't time to work on the fire controls. Desperate, he sent impulses, shutting down whole blocks of computer memory. Finally, something worked. The weapon system turned off. Frantically, he made the ship roll left and applied full thrust to escape a spread of torpedoes. The two fleets were coming together quickly, with him in between. Takata Jim intended to dive into the second fleet and stop behind it, conveying by his actions what he couldn't say by radio, that he was seeking protection. But the controls wouldn't respond. He couldn't correct from his last evasive maneuver. He must have shut down too much memory. The longboat streaked outward at right angles to the converging fleets, away from both of them. Both armadas turned to follow. Chapter 113 Streaker Now, she said. The pilot needed no urging. He had already been adding momentum. Now he applied full power. Streaker's engines roared, and she left the atmosphere on a crackling trail of ionization. The acceleration could be felt even through stasis, even inside the fluid-filled bridge. The gray sea disappeared under a white blanket of clouds. The horizon became a curve, then an arc. Streaker fell outward into an ocean of stars.
They're following us, the skirmishers from up north.
How many?
About 20.
Tish listened to her neural link for a moment.
They're strung out, except for a fairly big group at the rear. Hardly any two of them seem to be of the same race. I hear shooting. They're fighting each other, even as they chase us.
How many in that final bunch?
Six, I think.
Well, let's see what we can do when we stretch our legs. The planet fell behind them as Lucky Ka sent Streaker accelerating in the direction Jillian had chosen. Beyond Kithrop's horizon, a great battle had begun. Her path kept her hidden by the planet's bulk for several minutes. Then they came into view of the conflagration. A million kilometers away, space was filled with bright explosions and hackle-raising shrieks that feebly penetrated the side screens. Tish commented,
"The big boys are fighting over Takata Jim. We might even make it out of the system before the major fleets could catch up with us."
Jillian nodded. Toshio's sacrifice had not been in vain.
"Then our problem is these little guys on our tail. Somehow we've got to shake them off. Maybe we can do a dodge behind the gas giant planet. How long until we can get to it?"
"Hard to judge, Jillian. Maybe an hour. We can't use overdrive in system, and we're carrying a lot of excess mass."
Tish listened to her link, concentrating.
"The ones on our tail have mostly stopped beating on each other. They may be damaged, but I think at least two of the lead ships will catch up with us about the time we reach the gas giant."
Jillian looked at the hollow tank. Kithrop had shrunk to a tiny ball in one corner, a sparkle of battle beyond it. On this side, a chain of small dots showed Streaker's pursuers. In the forward tank, a shining pastel-striped globe began to grow. A huge world of frigid gas, looking much like Jupiter, swelled slowly but perceptibly. Jillian pursed her lips and whistled softly.
"Well, if we can't outrun them,
I guess we'll have to try an ambush.
Tisht stared at her.
Chilean, those are battleships. We're only an overweight Snark-class survey ship.
Jillian grinned.
This Snark has become a boojum, girl. The Thenanin shell will do more than just slow us down, and we may be able to try something they'll never expect.
She didn't mention that given a chance, she wanted to hang around this system a while, in case of a miracle.
Have all loose objects been secured?
Standard procedure. It's been done.
Good. Please order all crew out of the central bay. They're to strap themselves in wherever they can.
Tisht gave the order, then turned back with a questioning look. Jillian explained.
We're slow because we're overweight, right? They'll be shooting at us before we reach the cover of the gas giant, let alone overdrive range. Tell me, Tisht, what's making us overweight?
The Thenanin shell.
And what else?
Tisht looked puzzled. Jillian hinted with a riddle. Living touch, the substance of motion, like air, forgotten until it's gone. Tisht stared blankly. Then she got it. Her eyes widened.
Pretty tricky, yes. It just might work at that. Still, I'm glad you told me. The crew are going to want to wear the right apparel.
Jillian tried to snap her fingers in the water and failed.
Spacesuits. You're right, Tisht. What would I do without you?
Chapter 114 Galactics. The side battle amongst all the remnant forces seems to have moved away from the planet, a Paha warrior reported. They are streaming away from Kithrop, chasing a rather large vessel. The Soro Krat finished paring a ling plum. She fought to hide the nervous tremor in her left arm.
Can you identify the one they pursue?
It does not appear to be the quarry.
The Paha tastefully ignored the fleet mistress's obvious wave of relief on hearing this.
It is too large to be the Earth ship. We have tentatively identified it as a crippled Thenanin. Although...
Yes?
Krat asked archly.
The Paha hesitated. It behaves strangely. It is inordinately massive, and its motors seem to have a quasi-Tim Brimey tone. It is already too far to read clearly.
Krat grunted.
What is our status?
The Tandu parallel us, sniping at our flanks as we do theirs. We both chase the Earth Scout. Both of us have ceased firing at the boat, except when it gets too close to the other side.
Krat growled.
This vessel leads us farther and farther from the planet, from the true quarry. Have you contemplated a scout ship whose very purpose may have been to accomplish this?
He snapped. The Paha considered, then nodded.
Yes, Fleet Mother, it would be just like a Tim Brimey or Wolfling trick. What do you suggest?
Krat was filled with frustration. It had to be a trick. Yet she couldn't abandon the chase, or the Tandu would capture the scout ship. And the longer the chase went on, the worse the attrition on both sides. She threw the plum across the room. It splattered dead center on the rayed spiral glyph of the library. A startled Pill jumped and squeaked in dismay, then glared at her insolently.
Transmit standard truce call 3, Krat commanded with distaste. Contact the Tandu stalker. We must put an end to this farce and get back to the planet at once.
The Tandu stalker asked the trainer one more time.
Can you arouse the acceptor?
The trainer knelt before the stalker, offering its own head.
I cannot. It has entered an orgasmic state. It is overstimulated. Operant manipulation does not achieve success.
Then we have no metaphysical way to investigate the strange chase behind us.
We do not.
We can only use physical means. The stalker's legs ratcheted. Go and remove your head. With your last volition, place it in my trophy rack. The trainer rasped assent.
May the new one I grow serve you better.
Indeed, but first, the stalker suggested, arrange to open a talk line with the sorrow. I shall sever the leg I use to talk with them, of course. But talk to them we now must. Buwalt bit at his elbow spikes, then used them to preen his ridge crest. He had guessed correctly. He had taken the last 6 Thenanin ships out of the battle between the Tandu and the Sorrow, and arrived at the planet in time to join a long chase. 10 ragged ships were ahead of him, chasing an object that could only dimly be made out. More speed, he urged. The others are uncoordinated. While the Tandu and Sorrow chase a ruse, we are the only fair-sized squadron in the vicinity. We must chase. Far ahead of the Thenanin, a Gubru captain ruffled its feathers and cackled.
We catch up. We catch up with the lumbering thing. And look, now that we are near, look and see that its emanations are human. They fly inside the shell, but now we are near and can look and see and catch that which is inside that shell. Now we are near, and we will catch them.
Failure was still possible, of course, but total defeat would be unpermissible.
If we cannot catch them,
it reminded itself,
then we must make certain to destroy them.
Chapter 115 Streaker. The gas giant loomed ahead. The heavily laden Streaker lumbered toward it.
They'll expect us to dive in close for a tight hyperbolic,
Tish commented.
It's generally a good tactic when being chased in a planetary system. A quick thrust while we're swinging near the planet can translate into a major shift in direction.
Jillian nodded.
That's what they'll expect, but that's not what we'll do.
They watched the screens as 3 large blips grew and then took form as solid figures, ships with ugly battle scars and uglier weapons. The great bulk of the planet began to intrude even as the pursuing ships grew larger.
Are all Fens secured?
Yes.
Then you choose the time, Lieutenant. You have a better feel for space battles than I. You know what we want to do.
Tish clapped her jaws together.
I do, Jillian.
They dove toward the planet.
Soon they'll be committed.
Tish's eyes narrowed. She concentrated on sound images transmitted by her neural link. The bridge was silent except for the nervous clicking of dolphin sonar. Jillian was reminded of tense situations on human ships when half the crew would be whistling through their teeth without ever being aware of it.
Get ready,
Tish told the engineering crew by intercom. The pursuing ships disappeared briefly behind the planet's limb.
Now,
she cried for Suessi to hear.
Open the rear locks. Activate all pumps.
She swung to the pilot.
Launch that decoy probe. Hard lateral acceleration. Apply stasis to compensate all but 1G rearward. Repeat. Allow 1 gravity rearward in the ship.
At the control boards and the bridge sprouted red lights. Forewarned, the crew overrode safeguards as the contents of Streaker's central bay flew out behind her into the vacuum of open space. The Gubru captain was concerned with the Pfaka's ship encroaching on its lead. The commander contemplated maneuvers to destroy the Pfaka, but the master computer suddenly squawked frantically for attention.
They have not done that,
the captain chanted as it stared in disbelief at the display.
They cannot have done such a thing. They cannot have found such a devilish trap. They cannot have...
It watched the Pathanka ship collide, relativistically, with a barrier that had not been there minutes before. It was only a diffuse stream of gas particles drifting in their path. But unexpected, it met the Pathaka warship's screens like a solid wall. At a fair fraction of light speed, any barrier was deadly.
"Veer off!"
the Gubru commanded.
"Fire all weapons on the quarry!"
Fiery energy lanced out, but the beams struck an intangible wall between the Gubru and the rapidly turning Earthship.
"Water!"
it shrieked as it read the spectral report.
"A barrier of water vapor! A civilized race could not have found such a trick in the library. A civilized race could not have stooped so low. A civilized race would not have..."
It screamed as the Gubru ship hit a cloud of drifting snowflakes. Lightened by megatons, Streaker screamed about in an arc far tighter than she could have managed minutes before. Her locks closed, and the ship slowly refilled with air. Internal anti-gravity was reapplied. Her spacesuited crew fan flew back to their duty stations from hull rooms where they had taken refuge. In the still water-filled bridge, Jillian watched the annihilation of the first two pursuing vessels. The crew cheered as the third battered cruiser swerved desperately, then suffered a malfunction at the last moment and collided disastrously with the diffused cloud. It dissolved into a flat ball of plasma.
"The rest of them are still out of sight beyond the gas giant," Jillian said. "After the chase from Kithrop, they'll think they know our dynamic and never guess we could turn around like this."
Tisht looked less certain.
"Perhaps. We did fire off a decoy probe along our old flight path, mimicking our radiation. They may chase it. At least, I'd be willing to bet they'll come in on a tight and fast hyperbolic.
And we'll pick 'em off as they come."
Jillian felt a little giddy. There was just a chance they might be able to do it cleanly, so cleanly that they might be able to lie low to wait a little longer for Hikahi and Krydike, for another miracle. Streaker groaned as she fought to change direction.
"Suessi says the wall braces are under stress,"
Lucky Ka reported.
"He asks if you're going to be turning off stasis again or pulling any other... he calls them wild, crazy female maneuvers. His words, sir."
Jillian gave no answer. Suessi certainly didn't expect one. Streaker completed her sharp turn and sped back the way she had come, just as two more battlecruisers came into view around the limb of the gas giant.
"Get 'em, Tisht,"
Jillian told the Dolphin officer. An outrage she had not allowed to show in weeks of frustration came out in her voice.
"Use your own tactics, but get them."
"Yes."
Tisht noted Jillian's bald fists. She felt it too.
"Now!"
She whirled and called to the crew.
"Patiently we took the insults, patiently evil intent. Now we stop, patient no longer. Dream and logic, join in combat."
The bridge crew cheered. Streaker dove toward the surprised foe. Chapter 116 Galactics. The voice of the Sorrow Matriarch growled out of the communications web.
"Then we are in agreement to stop this chase and join our forces?"
The Tandu stalker promised itself it would remove two legs, not one, for the shame of making this agreement.
"Yes," it replied. "If we continue in the present manner, we will only erode ourselves down to nothing. You, Sorrow, fight well, or vermin. Let us unite and end it."
Krat made it explicit.
"We swear by Pact Number 1, the oldest and most binding to be found in the library, to capture the Earthlings together, to extract the information together, and to seek out together the emissaries of our ancestors, to let them be the judges of our dispute.
Agreed, the Tandu assented. Now, let us finish here and turn about together to seize the prize. Chapter 117 Takata Jim. He now understood what humans meant by a Nantucket sleigh ride. Takata Jim was tired. He had fled for what seemed like hours. Every time he tried to make the boat drift to one side so he could surrender to one party, the other side fired salvos between him and his goal, forcing him back. Then some time ago, he detected a long chain of ships leaving Kithrup in the other direction. It didn't take much to figure out that Streaker was making her move. It's over, then, he thought. I tried to do my duty as I saw it and save my own life at the same time. Now the die is cast. My plan is lost. I'm lost. There's nothing I can do except, maybe, buy Streaker a few minutes. Some time ago, the two fleets had stopped tearing at each other as they chased him. Takata Jim realized they were coming to an agreement. Suddenly, his receiver buzzed with a basic contact code in Galactic 1. The message was simple. Stop and surrender to the combined Tandu-Soro fleet. Takata Jim clapped his jaws together. He hadn't a transmitter, so he couldn't respond. But if he stopped dead in space, they would probably take that as a surrender. He delayed until the message had been repeated 3 times. Then he began decreasing speed, but slowly, very slowly, drawing out the time. When the Galactics had drawn close and their threats began to sound final, Takata Jim sighed and turned the longboat's fire control computers back on. The boat bucked as small missiles leaped away. He applied full thrust again. When both flotillas simultaneously fired volleys of missiles at him, he tried to evade, of course. It would be unsporting to give up. But he didn't have the heart for a major effort. Instead, while he waited, he worked on a poem. The saddest of things to a dolphin, even me, is to die alone.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 12. Cassette 12, Side 2.
Chapter 118 Streaker. The ambush at the gas giant was unexpected. The enemy came in close, using the great planet's gravity to swing about in a tight, hyperbolic turn. They were unprepared for an attack on their flanks. Compared with their breakneck dive, Streaker was almost motionless. She fell upon the pair of cruisers as they passed, lacing a web-like tracery of antimatter in their paths. One of the battleships blossomed into a fireball before Streaker's computers could even identify it. Its screens were probably already damaged after weeks of battle. The other cruiser was in better shape. Its screens flashed an ominous violet, and thin lines of exploding metal brightened its hull. But it passed through the trap and began decelerating furiously.
"It'll miss our mines, worse luck," Tisht announced. "There wasn't time to lay a perfect pattern."
"We can't have everything," Jillian replied. "You handled that brilliantly. He'll be some time getting back to us." Tisht peered at the screen and listened to her neural link.
"He may be very tardy if his engines keep missing. He's on a collision spiral with the planet."
"Goody. Let's leave him and see about the others." Streaker's motion was taking her away from the giant planet toward another group of 5 onrushing cruisers. Having witnessed part of the ambush, these were all adjusting course furiously.
"Now we'll see how well the Trojan Seahorse works," Jillian said. "The first bunch was close enough to read our engines and know we're Earth-made, but these guys were too far back. Has Soessi altered our power output along Thenanin lines as planned?"
Wadasetti whistled confirmation.
It's done. Suessi says it'll cut efficiency, though. He reminds you that our engines aren't feminine. Thank him for me. Now, for all our lives, what happens next depends on whether they're an unimaginative lot, as Tom guessed they'd be. Full power to the psi shields.
Eyes, sir.
Energy detectors lit up as the oncoming ships swept them with probe beams. The motley assortment of approaching ET vessels seemed to hesitate, then diverged.
Numbers 1, 4, and 5 are accelerating to pass us by,
Tisch announced. The bridge was filled with chattering dolphin applause.
What about the others?
Tisch's manipulator arm pointed to 2 dots in the holotank.
Decelerating and preparing for battle. We're picking up a beam cast in Galactic 10. It's a ritual challenge.
Tisch shook her head.
They do think we're feminine, but they want to stop and finish us off.
Who are they?
Brothers of the Night.
The magnification screens showed the 2 approaching battle wagons, dark and deadly, and growing nearer.
What to do?
Jillian kept her face impassive. She knew the Fen were watching her. We can't outrun them, especially not while we're faking feminine engines or wearing this heavy feminine shell. But only a fool would try to take them in a straight battle. A fighting fool like Tom, she thought ironically. Or Crydike. If either of them were in command, I'd be preparing condolence wreaths for the Brothers of the Night right now.
Jillian,
Tisch asked nervously. Jillian shook herself. Now, decide now. She looked at the approaching death machines.
Down their throats, she said.
Head toward Kithrop.
Chapter 119 Galactics.
We shall leave half of our fleet above the planet. None of the others will dare return, now that we have consolidated. We shall also send squadrons to clean the moons of hiding enemies, and to investigate the happenings out beyond the gas giant.
The Tandu stalker had only 4 legs now, instead of the former 6. The Sorrow, Krat, wondered what accident had befallen the leader of her unpleasant allies. Not that it really mattered. Krat dreamt of the day when she could personally detach the stalker's remaining limbs, and then all its head buds.
Is it possible that that outplanet chaos may be caused by the quarry?
He asked. The Tandu's expression was unreadable on the display screen.
All things are possible, even the impossible.
Sounded like a Tandu truism.
But the quarry could not escape even the stragglers' small might. If they are captured by them, the remnants will fight over the spoils. When our task force arrives, we will take over. It is simple.
Krat nodded. It did sound elegant. Soon, she told herself, soon we will wring the information out of the Earthlings, or sift it out of their wreckage. And soon thereafter, we will be before our ancestors themselves. I must try to make certain some few of the humans and dolphins are left alive after they tell us where the progenitor fleet is located. My clients do not appreciate it when I use them for entertainment. It would save trouble if I found amusements outside the family. Wistfully, she longed for a scrappy male of her own species, as a joint Tandu-Sorrow detachment of 13 ships blasted at full thrust toward the gas giant planet. Chapter 120 Streaker.
Damage to the stasis flanges on the port side, Botticelli announced. All missile slots in that sector are out.
Any harm to the inner hull?
Jillian asked anxiously. The Finn looked blank as he sounded out the damage control computer.
Nope,
The Thenanin shell's taken it all so far, but Suessi says the bracings are weakening.
They'll try to concentrate fire on the port side now that it's damaged,
Tish said.
And they'll expect us to turn away. Starboard missile batteries, fire mines at 40 degrees azimuth by 100 south. Slow thrust and lurk fuses. But no one's there. They will be. Fire. Helm, roll ship, left 2 radians per minute, pitch up 1 per minute.
Streaker shuddered and groaned as she turned slowly in space. Her screens flickered dangerously under powerful battle beams she could never hope to match. Not a blow had been struck on her opponents. They kept up easily with her lumbering attempts at evasion. From Streaker's shadowed quarter, 6 small missiles puffed lazily outward, then cut thrust. Streaker turned to try to protect her weakened side, a little more slowly than she was really capable of turning. Sensing a fatal weakness, the enemy's battleships followed the turn. Beams stabbed out to blast at Streaker's damaged side, at what the Brothers of the Night thought was their supine enemy's real hull. Streaker shook as the beams penetrated her shields and struck the Thenanin armor. Stasis flickered, giving them all eerily vivid feelings of deja vu. Even in the water-filled bridge, the blasts nearly threw the crew from their stations. Damage control spotters screamed reports of smoke and fire, of melting armor and buckling walls. The cruisers drifted confidently into the mined region, and the missiles exploded. Jillian clutched a handrail whitely. On those sensors that had not been blasted to vapor, the enemy was hidden by a cloud of roiling gas.
Hard thrust, 20 degrees by 270, Tish called. Stop, roll, and pitch.
The abused engine struggled. The bracings holding Streaker to her armored shell groaned as she accelerated in a new direction.
Blessings on that damned Thenanin armor,
one of the Finns sighed. Those beams would have sliced Streaker like toast. Jillian peered into one of the few operational holotanks, straining to see through the space smoke and debris. Finally, she saw the enemy.
A hit! A palpable hit!
She exulted. One of the battle wagons bore a gaping hole in its side, burning metal still curled away from the cavity, and secondary explosions shook the cruiser. The other one appeared, undamaged, but more wary than before.
Oh, keep hesitating, she urged them silently. Let us get a head start.
Anybody else around? She asked Tish. If these two ships were the only ones left, he'd be willing to turn the engines back on full power and even let the devil know they were an Earth ship. The lieutenant blinked.
Yes, Jillian. 6 more. Approaching rapidly.
Tish shook her head.
There's no way we'll get away from this new bunch. They're coming too fast. Sorry, Jillian.
The Brothers have made up their minds, Wadasetti announced. They're coming after us. Tish rolled her eyes. Jillian silently agreed. We won't fool them again.
Suessi calls. He wants to know if...
Jillian sighed. Hell, Hannes, there don't seem to be any more female tricks forthcoming. I'm fresh out of ideas. The two battleships drew nearer, chasing Streaker's stern. They held their fire, saving it for a total assault. Jillian thought about Tom. She couldn't help feeling that she had failed him. It really was a good plan, hun. I only wish I'd executed it competently for you. The enemy bore down on them, looming ominously. Then Lucky Kaz shouted,
Vector change!
The pilot's tail thrashed.
They're veering off, fleeing like mullets.
Jillian blinked in confusion.
But they had us. It's the newcomers, Jillian. Those 6 oncoming ships.
Tish shouted joyfully.
What? What about them?
Tish grinned as broadly as a Neo-Finn could manage.
They're feminine. They're coming in blasting, and it's not us they're shooting at.
The screen showed the pair of cruisers that had been chasing them, now in full flight, firing Parthian style at the approaching mini-flotilla. Jillian laughed.
Wadasetti, tell Suessi to shut down, put everything on idle, and pour out smoke. We want to play the gravely wounded soldier.
After a moment came the engineer's reply. Suessi says that will be no problem. No problem at all. Chapter 121 Galactics. Buault's crest riffled with waves of emotion. Krondosphere lay ahead of them, battered but proud. He had fought the old battle wagon lost since the first day of the battle, and Baron Ibrimsev, its commander. Buault longed to see his old comrade again.
Is there still no response? He asked the communicator.
No, Commander, the ship is silent. It is possible they just now sustained a fatal blow that...
Wait, there is something. A flashing light signal in uncoded open talk. They are sending from one of the viewing ports.
Buault edged forward eagerly.
What do they say? Do they require help?
The communications officer huddled before his monitor, watching the winking lights, jotting notes.
All weapons and communications destroyed, he recited. Life support and auxiliary drives still serviceable. Earthlings ahead, chased by a few dregs. We shall withdraw. Happy hunting. Krondosphere out.
Buault thought the message a little odd. Why would Embrasev want to pull out if he could still follow and at least draw fire from the enemy? Perhaps he was making a brave show in order not to hold them back. Buault was about to insist on sending aid anyway when the communications officer spoke again.
Commander, a squadron is outbound from the water planet. At least 10 vessels. I read signs of both Tandu and sorrow.
Buault's crest momentarily collapsed. It had come to pass, the very last alliance of heretics.
We have one chance. After the fugitives at once. We can overpower the remnants even as they overpower the Earthlings, and be off before the Tandu and sorrow arrive.
As his ship leapt outward, he had a message sent back to Krondosphere. May the great ghosts dwell with you. Chapter 122 Streaker.
That's a pretty sophisticated little computer you've kept hidden away all this time, Tish commented.
Jillian smiled.
It's actually Tom's.
The Finns nodded wisely. That was explanation enough. Jillian thanked the NIS machine for its hurry-up feminine translation. The disembodied voice whispered from a cluster of sparkles that floated near her, dancing and whirling amidst the fizzing oxy-water bubbles.
I could do nothing else, Jillian Baskin, it replied. You few lost Earthlings have accumulated in the course of heaping disasters upon yourselves more data than my masters have gathered in the last 1,000 years. The lessons about uplift alone will profit the Timbrimi, who are always willing to learn, even from wolflings.
The voice faded, and the sparkles vanished before Jillian could reply.
The signal parties returned from the viewport, Jillian, Tish said. The Thenanin have gone off chasing our shadows, but they'll be back. What do we do now?
Jillian felt tremors of adrenaline reaction. She had not planned beyond this point. There was only one thing she wanted desperately to do now. Only one destination in the universe she wanted to go.
Kithrop,
she whispered. Jillian shook herself.
Kithrop?
She looked at Tish, knowing what the answer would be, wishing it weren't so. Tish shook her sleek head.
There's a flotilla orbiting Kithrop now, Jillian,
No fighting. There must have been a winner in the big battle. Another squadron's heading this way. Fast. A big one. We don't want them to get close enough to see through our disguise.
Jillian nodded. Her voice didn't want to function. But she made the words come.
North, she said. Take us out along Galactic North, Tisht, to the transfer point. Full speed. When we get close enough, we'll dump the Seahorse and get the Ifni damned hell out of here with the ashes we've won.
The Dolphins returned to their posts. The rumble of the engines gathered strength. Jillian swam to one dark corner of the crystal dome, to a place where there was a chink in the Thenanin armor, where she could look at the stars directly. Streaker picked up speed. Chapter 123 Galactics. The Tandu Soro detachment was gaining on the strung-out fugitives. Mistress, a crippled Thenanin is approaching the transfer point on an escape trajectory. Krat squirmed on her cushion and snarled.
So? Casualties have left the battle area before. All sides try to evacuate their wounded. Why do you bother me when we are even now closing in?
The little Pila detector officer scuttled back into its cubbyhole. Krat bent to watch her forward screens. A small squadron of Thenanin struggled to keep ahead. Further on, at the edge of detection, sparks of desultory battle showed that the leaders were still bickering, even as they closed on the quarry. What if they're mistaken? Krat wondered. We chase the Thenanin. Who chase the remnants? Who chase what? Those fools might even be chasing each other. It didn't matter. Half the Tandu Soro fleet orbited Kithrop, so the Earthlings were trapped, one way or another. We'll deal with the Tandu in good time, she thought, and meet the Ancient Ones alone.
Mistress, the Pila shouted shrilly, there is a transmission from the transfer point.
Bother me one more time with inconsequentials!
She rumbled, flexing her mating claw threateningly. But the client interrupted her. The Pill dared to interrupt.
Mistress, it is the Earth ship. They taunt us. They defy us. They...
Show me, Krat hissed. It must be a trick. Show me at once.
The Pill ducked back into its section. On Krat's main screen appeared the hollow image of a man and several dolphins. From the man's shape, Krat could tell it was a female, probably their leader.
Stupid creatures unworthy of the name Sophans. Foolish presentient upspring of errant masters. We slip away from all your armed might, laughing at your clumsiness. We slip away as we always will, you pathetic creatures. And now that we have a real head start, you'll never catch us. What better proof that the progenitors favor not you, but us? What better proof?
The taunt went on. Krat listened, enraged, yet at the same time savoring the artistry of it. These men are better than I'd thought. Their insults are wordy and overblown, but they have talent. They deserve honorable, slow deaths.
Mistress, the Tandu with us are changing course. Their other ships are leaving Kithrop for the transfer point.
Krat hissed in despair.
After them! After them at once! We've followed them through space this far. The chase only goes on.
The crew bent to their tasks resignedly. The Earthship was in a good position to escape. At best, this would be a long chase. Krat realized that she would never make it home in time for mating. She would die out here. On her screen, the man continued to taunt them.
Librarian, she called. I do not understand some of the man's words. Find out what that phrase, nya nya, means in their beastly wolfling tongue.
Chapter 124 Tom Orley. Cross-legged on a woven mat of reeds, shaded by a floating wreck. He listened as a muttering volcano slowly sputtered into silence. Contemplating starvation, he listened to the soft, wet sounds of the endless weedscape and found in them a homely beauty. The squishy, random rhythms blended into a backdrop for his meditation. On the mat in front of him, like a focus mandala, lay the message bomb he had never set off. The container glistened in the sunlight of North Kithrop's first fine day in weeks. Highlights shone in dimpled places where the metal had been battered, as he had been. The dented surface gleamed still. Where are you now? The subsurface sea waves made his platform undulate gently. He floated in a trance through levels of awareness, like an old man poking idly through his attic, like an old-time hobo looking with mild curiosity through the slats of a moving boxcar. Where are you now, my love? He recalled a Japanese haiku from the 18th century by the great poet Yosa Buson. As the spring rains fall, soaking in them, on the roof, is a child's rag ball. Watching blank images in the dents on the side globe, he listened to the creaking of the flat jungle, its skittering little animal sounds, the wind riffling through the wet, flat leaves. Where is that part of me that has departed? He listened to the slow pulse of a world ocean, watched patterns in the metal, and after a while, in the reflections in the dents and creases, an image came to him. A blunt, bulky wedge shape approached a place that was a not place, a shining blackness in space. As he watched, the bulky thing cracked open. The thick carapace slowly split apart like a hatching egg. The shards fell away, and there remained a slender, nubbed cylinder, looking a bit like a caterpillar. Around it glowed a nimbus, a thickening shell of probability that hardened even as he watched. No illusion, he decided. It cannot be an illusion. He opened himself to the image, accepting it, and from the caterpillar, a thought winged to him. Blossoms on the pear, and a woman in the moonlight reads a letter there. His slowly healing lips hurt as he smiled. It was another haiku by Buson. Her message was as unambiguous as could be under the circumstances. She had somehow picked up his trance poem and responded in kind. Jill, he cast as hard as he could. The caterpillar shape, sheathed in a cocoon of stasis, approached the great hole in space. It dropped forward toward the not place, grew transparent as it fell, then vanished. For a long time, Tom sat very still, watching the highlights on the metal globe slowly shift as the morning passed. Finally, he decided it wouldn't do him or the universe any harm if he started doing something about survival. Chapter 125 The Skiff.
Between you two crazy males, have you come any closer to figuring out what he's talking about?
Kipiro and Sao just stared back at Hikaki. They turned back to their discussion without answering her, huddling with Kraidaiki, trying to interpret the captain's convoluted instructions. Hikaki rolled her eyes and turned to Toshio.
You'd think they'd include me in these seances of theirs. After all, Kraidaiki and I are mates.
Toshio shrugged.
Kraidaiki needs Sao's language skill and Kipiru's ability as a pilot. But you saw their faces. They're halfway into the whale dream right now. We can't afford to have you that way while you're in command.
Hmm. Hikaki spumed, only slightly mollified.
I suppose you've finished the inventory, Toshio?
Yes, sir, he nodded. I have a written list ready.
We're well enough stocked in consumables to last to the first transfer point, and at least one beyond that. Of course, we're in the middle of nowhere, so we'll need at least 5 transfer jumps to get anywhere near civilization. Our charts are pitifully inadequate, our drives will probably fail over the long haul, and few ships our size have even taken transfer points successfully. Aside from all that, and the cramped living quarters, I think we're all right. Hikahi sighed. We can't lose anything by trying. At least the galactics are gone. Yeah, he agreed. It was a nice stroke, Jillian taunting the ETs at the last minute. It let us know they got away and got the ETs off our backs. Don't say ETs, Toshio. It's not polite. You may offend some nice Kantan or Linton one day if you get into the habit. Toshio swallowed and ducked his head. No matter where or when, no lieutenant had ever been known to slacken off on a MIDI. Yes, sir, he said. Hikahi grinned and flicked a small splash of water on the youth with her lower jaw. Duty, duty, brave shark biter, what reward could taste better? Toshio blushed and nodded. The skiff started to move again. Kipiru was back in the pilot's saddle. Gridaiki and Sao chattered excitedly in a semi-primal rhythm, which still sent shivers down Hikahi's spine. And Sao had said that Gridaiki was toning it down on purpose. She was still getting used to the idea that Gridaiki's injury might have been a door opening, rather than a closing. The skiff lifted from the sea and began to speed eastward, following Crydike's hunch. What about passenger morale? Hikahi asked Toshio. Well, I guess it's all right. That pair of Kikui are happy so long as they're with Denny. And Denny's happy. Well, she's happy enough for now. Hikahi was amused. Why should the youth be embarrassed about Denny's other preoccupation? She was glad the two young humans had each other, as she had Crydike. In spite of his new eerie side, Crydike was the same dolphin. The newness was something he used, something he seemed only to have begun exploring. He could hardly speak, but he conveyed his great intellect and his caring in other ways. What about Charlie? She asked Toshio. Toshio sighed. He's still embarrassed. They had found the chimp a day after the great earthquakes, clinging to a floating tree trunk, sopping wet. He had been unable to speak for 10 hours, and had kept climbing the walls in the skiff's tiny hold until he finally calmed down. Charlie finally admitted that he had scrambled to the top of a tall tree just before the island blew. It had saved his life, but the stereotype mortified him. Toshio and Hikahi crowded in behind Kipiru's station and watched as the ocean rolled swiftly beneath the skiff. For minutes at a time, the sea turned a brilliant green as they passed over great swatches of vine. The little boat sped toward the sun. They had been searching for almost a week, ever since Streaker had departed. First found had been Toshio, swimming purposefully westward, never giving up. Then Denny had led them to another island where there was a tribe of Kikui. While she negotiated another treaty, they searched for and found Charles Dart. Takata Jim's Stenos were all missing or dead. After that had come one last and apparently forlorn search. They had been at this last phase for several days now. Hikahi was about to give up. They couldn't go on wasting time and consumables like this, not with the journey they had ahead of them. Not that they really had much of a chance. No one had ever heard of a voyage like they planned. A cross-galactic journey in the skiff would make Captain Bly's epic crossing of the Pacific in the Bounty's longboat seemed like an afternoon jaunt. She kept her appraisal to herself, though. Gridaiki and Kipiru probably understood what lay ahead of them.
Toshio seemed to have guessed part of it already. There was no reason to inform the others until they had to cut the rations for the fourth time. She sighed. Of what else are heroes made than men and women who, like us, try? Kipiru's fluting call of triumph was like a shrill trumpet. He squalled and tossed on his platform. The skiff rolled left and right in a wiggle-waggle, then went into a screaming climb.
What the f-? Toshio stopped himself. Holy jumping turtlefish, Kipiru! What is it?
Hikahi used a harness arm to grab a wall stanchion and looked out a port. She sighed for a third time, long and deep. The smoke from his fire momentarily hid the boat from sight. The first he knew of it was the sonic boom that rolled over him, nearly knocking over his drying racks. The human standing on the woven reed mat almost dove for cover, but a hunch made him stop and look up instead. His eyes were sun-squinted. Crow's feet, that had not been there a few weeks before, lay at the corners. His beard was black with thin gray flecks. It had grown out and nearly stopped itching, almost covering a ragged scar that ran down one cheek. Shading his eyes, he recognized the wild maneuvers before he did the outlines of the tiny ship. It streaked high into the sky and looped about, coming back to screech past him again. He reached out to steady the drying racks against the thunder. No sense in letting the meat go to waste. It had taken a lot of work to harvest it, strip it, and prepare it. They might need it for the voyage ahead. He wasn't sure how the Fen would take to the stuff, but it was nourishing, the only food on the planet that an Earthling could eat. Gubru jerky, tandu strips, and flayed episiarch would never make it into haute cuisine, of course, but perhaps they were an acquired taste. He grinned and waved as Kipiru finally calmed down enough to bring the skiff to a halt nearby. How could I have ever doubted he'd still be alive? Hikahi wondered joyfully. Jillian said he had to live. None of the Galactics could ever touch him. How could they? And why, in the wide universe, was I ever worried about getting home? Postscript. Dolphin names often sound as if they are Polynesian or Japanese. In some cases, this is true. In general, however, the neofin chooses for a name a sound he likes, usually a polysyllabic word with strong alternating vowels and consonants. In Anglic, the words man, men, and mankind apply to humans without reference to gender. On those occasions when gender is important, a female human is referred to as a femme, and a male human as a mel. Dolphin languages are the author's invention, and are not meant to represent the communication of natural dolphins and whales today. We are only beginning to understand the place of the cetaceans in the world, and we are just beginning to understand our own. The author wishes to thank all those who helped with this work, with their advice and criticism and encouragement, especially Mark Grigier, Anita Everson, Patrick Marr, Rick and Patty Harper, Ray Feist, Richard Spall, Ethan Munson, and, as always, Dan Brin. Lou Aronica and Tapan King of Bantam Books were most helpful with encouragement when morale was lowest. The translated haiku by Yosa Buson were from an anthology of Japanese literature compiled and edited by Donald Keene, published by Grove Press. The world's many paths diverge in both reality and imagination. The creatures of this novel are all fanciful, but it may happen that some of our fellow mammals will one day be our partners. We owe it to that possible future to let their potential survive. David Brin, August 1982. Epilogue. Rest. Rest and listen. Rest and listen and learn, cried Ikey. For the star tide rises in the currents of the dark, and we have waited long for what must be.
The End. You've been listening to Star Tide Rising by David Brin, narrated by George Wilson. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.